Hi, this is Matt Stevens in Abu Dhabi, and we're starting another of our Sunday Speed Geeks, somehow associated with several groups. Let's see, we're using, first of all, well, Webheads is on the screen right now on the whiteboard, and we're in the Learning Times office. I always like to give the date. Today is the 2nd of January. We've just been wishing everybody a Happy New Year, and it's a Sunday, as usual, and we almost always meet here at this time. So let's see, and we're going to talk today with Michael Coughlin, who's in Australia, and Barbara Dew, whom we affectionately know, call B. And we have Maisie, Derek, Dennis, and Nina in the chat with us. And we might just ask everyone to say hi to us in a moment. But we're going to talk about, so I'll just put on the screen what we're going to talk about. This is our chat, our topic for today. More or less, we're going to talk about the future of learning in a networked world. And there's actually a wiki for that, which is on the web tour. And sort of, this is a, there are two reasons for this conversation on this particular day, and one of them is that we had nothing else on, so we decided we'd fill this gap. But we've been, for a long time, since B and Michael and I got together in Brazil this last summer and sort of toured the countryside as flag bearers for the future of learning in a networked world. This is the fourth time, apparently, this has taken place. First time was in New Zealand. I think Derek was there. We can mention something about that. And second one, I guess that was with John Isles and Michael and I in Bangkok, and they went on up to Laos, I believe. And then also there was one in Washington State, Canada, last summer. So this, no, the summer before. But this one was in Brazil, and it's kind of just a very loose organization, just like we are. So anyway, basically, that's an introduction, and maybe Michael can take it from there. How are you doing, Michael? How are you doing, Michael? How's it going over there in Australia? Could be a problem with Michael's audio. Would anybody else like to say hi? Derek, maybe you can tell us a little bit about that first Future of Learning in a Networked World event.
All right. I'm going to interrupt Derek in case Derek is actually awake and with us. If I'm slow in coming on, my system has this weird thing with Illuminate in the last few months where it might take two or three clicks of the microphone for it to activate. So I will eventually respond. It's just that it might take me a few clicks to grab the mic. I guess I'd like to just clarify whether or not we're going to talk about what we saw and did and thought in Brazil and South America in our recent jaunt there, or are we going to talk about network learning in a future world, or a bit of both perhaps? So maybe we can just clarify that, Vance.
Well, Michael, you've got the floor, so I believe you put this slide up that I just put on the whiteboard, so we can talk. We don't really need to. I mean, we're just, you know, using future of learning in a networked world as a kind of a springboard. I was listening to your conversation with Stephen Ridgway and B just recently. You were talking about WikiLeaks. I thought, I don't know if we want to continue with that here in great detail, but that's kind of the future of learning in a networked world. Certainly has brought people up, you know, on the implications of our networked learning. But anyway, Hal, it looks like you've got more insights from the Horizon report there, which is on the whiteboard right now.
Yeah, so I'll just mention the things that are there on screen, and the Australia-New Zealand Horizon report was released about a month ago. It's the Antipodean equivalent of the one that's produced globally, but mostly out of North America each year. And for the third year this time, the Horizon Report for the New Media Consortium has come down to Australia and gathered a bunch of educators together and asked us our opinions about what we think is going to happen in the near future in terms of education and the not so near future. And you can see there the time frames on the board, on the whiteboard, are 1 year, 2 to 3 years, 4 to 5 years. So rather than me talk about all of these things at the moment, we can come back to any one of these. But what the Horizon Report said is that in the next 12 months, according to this report, mobile internet devices and the use of e-books will become mainstream. So that's the use, that's the value of that, the time frame. So it's not that they're going to happen or sort of be bits and pieces here and there. This report is actually saying that within 1 year, mobile internet devices and e-books will become mainstream. Within 2 to 3 years, open content and augmented reality, likewise, will become mainstream. And 4 to 5 years, gesture-based computing and visual data analysis. So many of these sorts of reports are best guesses. And I read somewhere recently that humanity is dreadful at predicting the future. We invariably get it wrong. So this is not a roadmap of what's going to happen. This is the best guess of 30 or 40 educators around Australia and New Zealand about what they think. Now, given that we're having a conversation tonight my time, daytime today, on the future of network learning, it's interesting to look at these different categories of technology and wonder which of these are networked or not. So I'm just going to stop there for a minute and kind of see if someone wants to comment on anything that's up there, or do we want to go back and talk about past FLNWs to create that sort of context?
Well, this is Nina in Maryland. I'm looking at the whiteboard, the technologies to watch. I think that's what we're supposed to be commenting on. I just wanted to mention that I read an article in the Washington Post a few weeks ago, maybe, about iPhones and other smartphones and how they were using up so much bandwidth, and as more and more people get them, that there isn't going to be enough bandwidth to accommodate all of the devices out there, and they're kind of all going to start crashing. And I wondered if you had heard that as well. It made me less anxious to get a smartphone, that's for sure. Any thoughts about that?
No, there was no comment about that kind of thing, and I haven't heard that kind of discussion in Australia, but let's see what someone else might say. Maisie, gesture-based computing is, in its basic form, already happening with what you do on an iPhone or any kind of touch-sensitive device where with your fingers you can make a picture bigger or make text bigger. That's gesture-based computing. And also the popular Wii game tool, where you're actually doing a physical activity which is being recorded on screen, is also gesture based, and there's a whole other range of applications. So we've got it, it's here, but what role is it going to play in education, in mainstream education in the future? But Bree, was it I think Marilyn, the comment about using bandwidth, anyone got anyone to say in reaction to that?
In the meantime, I'm going to look for the link to the original article.
I think Google and Verizon certainly would agree with that, and they have the solution, of course, and that basically if you need more bandwidth, you can buy it. And that's quite an issue at the moment. It's, you know, one of these things that kind of like the apps versus the the generative web. It's one of these things that is going to turn computing on its head, especially if, I don't know, in the U.S. that has a lot to do with it, but seems that there's a Federal Communications Commission or something like that that's supposed to be regulating this, which is normally asleep at the wheel. So that's going to be a really big issue. That's an important one. Well, basically, if I throw in another buzzword, it's net neutrality. You know, it's net neutral suggests that you shouldn't have to, that you don't prioritize bandwidth on what you pay for it, and that's what Google and Verizon are trying to circumvent, because the regulations have to do with our existing connections, it's the future connections, the wireless ones, that are being deregulated.
The whole conversation here in Australia is bogged down in what we call the NBN, the National Broadband Network, because until now, what we have in Australia is often referred to as fraudband, because if you compare us to the United States, to Korea and Taiwan and Asia in particular, our broadband is a joke. So Australia is more concerned on beefing up our broadband network. And I think that's where kind of our headset is at the moment. But, okay, so we need to take on board the fact that these sorts of uses of mobile internet devices, ubiquitous devices, are going to have a profound impact on the amount of data that's flying around and the ability of the infrastructure to carry it. But that doesn't mean we don't do it, of course. Nina has asked you'd like about Maisie's Netstick. So, Maisie.
I don't know if Maisie has a microphone. Just text if you can talk to us, Maisie. But she was telling us last week, we were just having a tapped-in chat, and she has a Netstick, which it's basically the same kind of thing that they put into the computers at the Braz TESOL conference so that they could network certain computers. They have so many of the Netsticks. And yeah, I think it's the plug-in modem, the ones that they were using in Sao Paulo at the conference, the Braz TESOL conference. So I know, yes, that's right. Well, yeah, and Maisie says she can use it on the bus wherever she is. And well, basically, I know that some years ago, Aiden was using these things and she'd be in her office and she'd be chatting with me. Maybe she wanted me to talk to her class, and she'd walk down the hall and she'd be outside the class and telling me what she was doing. And then inside the class, of course, there you are. I mean, now it's kind of on your mobile phone if you have a 3G hookup. But obviously, you know, that just makes it possible to just walk around. Once everybody's walking around with this kind of connectivity, you know, think of the things we can do in the classroom. You know, that's, of course, I suppose you could say that it already exists in a way, considering that people, that educators aren't really using 3G technology in the classroom. Wonder why? Well, I guess it's not ubiquitous enough. What are some of the stumbling blocks preventing us from using those things? Just to put something on the audio, Maisie is saying that she has three of these Netsticks. She has one for Israel, one for the USA, and one for the UK. I had one in USA at one point. It's difficult for me traveling there to get one, although you can go into computer stores now and you can buy them, and you can buy a temporary connectivity with them. So, yeah, you can buy them off the shelf. And you get a little card, and you get a certain amount of money, and you can go top it up online if you need it. So it's possible to, but if you're actually in the United States, you can contract with somebody. I think it's AT&T, it might be, or maybe it's Verizon. But you contract with someone to have this device that fits in your computer, in your laptop, and then you're always connected. And as you move from down the highway, it keeps changing satellites, and you're just always connected. I think I had one that was called an air card. I think it was Verizon.
So do you have to have an account with Verizon or AT&T in order to use the NetStick?
Yes, you do. It was a problem for me in the United States because you had to take out a contract for so many months, and that got to be a really kind of expensive. But now you can go into computer stores and you can buy them. You can buy them with a little card. So, and you just keep topping up the card. So it's getting a lot more convenient to use. You can probably get them in duty-free airports as well.
They're really fantastic. And Vance, you asked, what are some of the stumbling blocks to this permanent and ubiquitous connectedness? One of them is security and notions of obligation and responsibility. So what has been raised in, I'm sure it's been raised in lots of places, but conversations we've been having here in Australia, not only with children in schools, but also adults in an adult learning environment, what happens when they come to the institution with these computers that are network enabled via these NetSticks or mobile prepaid cards, and they're completely independent of the institution. So in theory, they can, you know, they can hack, they can research how to make bombs, they can do all the wicked things, even though they're on a computer in the organization under the care of a teacher of that organization. And does the organization have a responsibility to protect the student, the community, from bad use of that machine that they are running with their net connection that they're paying for? Or is it a new world where the individual student is completely free to do whatever they want?
I think it's very difficult to control once you are connected. I mean, there is control, obviously, of the network through IPs and through providers. Here in Brazil, there is a law that is about to pass. We are resisting that breaks the net neutrality, because it means that you are being followed by all the providers, something they won't be able to do. And the moment you set criteria, these criteria obviously are not, discussed with the population, so you don't know what the criteria are for tracking. So we are all fighting here for net neutrality, but many people just don't understand how things work. And obviously, if you mention to people that they can be spied upon, or that can be threats to your computer, to your privacy, and so on, they'll sign anything. They don't understand the further implications of having neutral net, and also of having this freedom. So I think that basically our role as educators is to show students how this works, and explain that if they want to have this freedom to do, they should not abuse it. So anyway.
I guess if we look at what's in the Horizon report, I'm not at all surprised about mobile and internet devices within a year. I mean, I would say in many places they're already there. I think by technologies to watch, you're talking about technologies in education. Is that correct? Yeah, okay. He Mike says yes in the chat. So, you know, there's so many technologies. When I came to the UAE 10 years ago, you know, people were trying to block MSN Messenger, you know, and having students who were in learning centers, you know, were being told, were being watched. Oh, if you're on MSN Messenger, you know, this is something bad. But of course, now we this is just acceptable. In my classroom, it goes on. The students are on Facebook. They're on Messenger. I don't even blink anymore. You know, I mean, they're just communicating whatever. You know, as long as they're engaged with what I'm doing, it's fine, or what I'm trying to get them to do. So it's becoming quite acceptable. And the more recently, a couple of years ago where I work, they were trying to prevent students from bringing their mobile telephones into class. They were told they should leave them out of class. But now they're just coming into class. Some students have two or three of them for different reasons. And sometimes they're sitting there and they're texting during class. I don't really approve of that, but you know, I don't really break my stride over it either. So I'm thinking, if they're here with their mobile telephones, well, why don't we use them? You know, I suppose somebody was talking about these little devices that you can set up in the class where you get to vote. You know, I can't remember the name for it, where people have a something in hand and they punch it and puts a vote. And I mentioned, well, you know, they have these services, like there's poll everywhere, poll anywhere, keypad, I don't know, Michael says it's called a keypad, there's another name for it, but basically you don't need a dedicated device, you have a mobile, everyone has mobile telephones, so they can just text a number and vote, you know, or answer questions that way, and poll anywhere is one of the ones that Wesley Fryer is always talking about. Or it could be poll everywhere. If you go to one of those, then it takes you to the URL, the correct URL. But that's just one example that people could be using their mobile phones in class for, you know, responding. And of course, since you can do almost anything, you can do on a computer. You can use browsers and things like that. Of course, you can interact in so many ways. But this just the potential is just. Not even considered, really. And why is that?
I think there are a whole range of problems here, because obviously everybody has a mobile, but every time you make, let's say, a call, it costs something. I teach at a private school. They already pay a lot of money to attend school. So are you going to make all your students vote and pay for the calls? Who is going to pay for them? The institution? No way. This is a problem I face when I am giving my students technology. They're all well off. It's not that. But there are many people who are on scholarships and they complain and they say, you know, we want things that we don't have to upload to our computers. They also complain about the time that is spent on it at home, that parents do not allow them to stay so much time connected and doing things. So there are other problems that come up. Although these tools are ubiquitous and they will use their mobile phones outside class, many of them won't use them for, let's say, educational activities. So this is what happens here.
The cost is a separate issue and a valid one, but in terms of whether or not students are allowed to do this kind of thing in class, I think it's about a dialogue with them and talking about what's appropriate use and what's not appropriate use. And I was listening to a guy recently talk about what he's done with his class, year 11 and 12. This is 16, 17-year-old students in an Australian high school. And the whole school, in fact, has decided students can have phones on and use them anytime. They don't have to ask permission, and they explain what is appropriate use and basically trust students, and they think that they report that the numbers of students abusing that privilege are really minimal. That if it's explained to students and they're given the responsibility and there's some discussion of what's appropriate use, it's really not a problem. It just doesn't address the cost that Bea has just talked about. And I just want to share with you one nice little anecdote that this guy, his name is Andrew Douch. He said one day he was in his classroom, and there was a girl down the back of the class who was messing around and not paying attention and hadn't been for some time. He has all the student mobile phone numbers, so he messaged her and said something like, you know, Helen, it's time you got back to work. He watched as Helen received the message. She looked at the message, read it, and then looked up at Andrew and just smiled and then got back to work. Later on that day, the student came up to him and said, Mr. Douch, I really like that, what you did today. Because, one, you're the teacher and I was messing around, so you need to tell me, you know, that's your job, and so you did tell me. And two, you did not diss me in front of my friends. So just an example of how the mobile phone and the messaging function can be used in a really effective way to connect that teacher and that student.
Yeah, I think that's the way attitudes change, and that's actually an example of what I'm talking about, where, you know, it fits seamlessly. A lot of times they used to give presentations around the UAE where they used to block social networking sites. They'd block Twitter and things like that. And Flickr is just, actually, I just hit on Macy's picture, not Macy's, sorry, B's Flickr photo there, and I found it blocked here at the PI. I think it's because they have it in their NetSense or something like that. But it's actually okay to use Flickr in the PI, in the UAE. But anyway, so the thing is that when I was giving the presentations, people would say, well, we can't use this because we have all these blockages here. And I would say, well, you know, you need to be ready for when those blockages are released. You know, you need to be ready, for example, when texting on mobile phones becomes virtually free, and you can actually do that. You need to be ready to drive the situation rather than letting it be driven by external forces. So I think that's kind of important. And this, so when you have stumbling blocks, then you keep everybody in a situation where they're not learning, and that's really a shame. And I think some of these considerations are just going to disappear. You know, it's just going to be so natural for people to bring laptops into class and sit there and set them up. Someone mentioned that the laptops were forbidden in one place because they were distracting the students, but that approach of Andrew Douch is exactly what you need to do. You need to explain to students what's appropriate, what's not, and of course there are many good affordances of bringing laptops to class and having them available in class. You can Google what the teacher's talking about, you can have a back channel, there's all kinds of things that you can actually do with them. So, yeah, how about some comments from some other people here in the chat? We have two Dennises. Yes, we do. Like Dennis made it from Phoenix. Hiya, Dennis. Anybody else have comments here?
Yeah, in American schools, sometimes students in special education, have individualized education plans, I think they're called IEPs. That allow them to take notes using laptops.
Incidentally, you might introduce Lynn from Lynn Luther from last week. She joined us. Turns out she's a grad student in California, I think, and she's into virtual worlds. And maybe I should introduce you to Asna Kantorab, that's Dennis Newsom in Germany. Let's see, looks like we don't really have virtual worlds in this list here and the technologies to watch, but Lynn was telling us some interesting things last week. I don't know if you have a microphone, do you, Lynn? Okay, well, Lynn has no microphone, but last week she was telling us, I guess, the teen grid is no more. It was supposed to end at the end of December. And also, she said that Second Life was stopping its educator discounts. and causing some people to migrate from there. Have you had any problem with that, Dennis? Do you notice any migration of educators from Second Life? I'm asking Dennis because I'm presuming Dennis might have a microphone.
The microphone, has he successfully grabbed it? If I have, the answer is yes. We've noticed this most definitely. I'm live on an island in Second Life called Edunation One, and an awful lot is happening, not all very positive there because of increasing costs.
Now, interestingly, it's nice to see Lynn back because she's getting into some other sims. There's Open Sim, I think. And then maybe you could remind me of what that other one we joined last week. I haven't been back there, I have to admit. Vinny Sue, whom a lot of you know, has set up an Open Sim site, I believe, on his server, and he's got it linked into Sludal. So it looks like this kind of thing is going to cause people to examine more some of the Open Sim spaces, which, well, Second Life was there, didn't really have the traction because people were in Second Life and kind of like Ning, you know, but all of a sudden when Ning became not free, people had to look at other spaces to do what they were doing in Ning. Any suggestions there from anybody in the chat? Reaction Grid, that was it. Liz just mentioned that In Worlds, she says she likes Reaction Grid and In Worlds. They both look promising. Okay, any other comments? Why is that not in your list, Michael? Did that not come up, or was it, I'm just curious why simulations like that didn't appear in the Horizon list this year. Any reason for that?
Third time lucky, I got the mic. Nothing specifically mentioned, but they were on last year's, and I think they were actually in the one the year before, but they were just off the radar with this year's discussion. And I think partly, rightly or wrongly, fairly or not, because of what Second Life has done in the last 12 months to educators, I think has had a huge impact around the place. A lot of people have dropped out and done things like gone to Jocadia Grid and the Reaction Grid and all these other ones. So it's kind of been starting again. And the problems that just keep being mentioned about virtual worlds is the time it takes to become proficient in their use, the sort of hardware you've got to have to be able to effectively use it, and you've got to have a bandwidth that's capable of taking it. Now, there are a lot of obstacles, and I think there's a feeling around most educators that it's not going to be an easy one anytime soon. And even if you do master all those things, that it's practical application across the board is limited. Again, we're thinking mainstream. You know, mainstream meaning it's used by just about everybody for every subject in all circumstances.
And there's some discussion in the chat about how long it takes to get proficient in a virtual world, and Lynn said at least 2 weeks, and people are surprised that it could be that short a time. It's kind of like going to a country and learning the language. I mean, you probably can learn some things to converse a little bit in 2 weeks, but of course it's going to take you 2 months or 2 years to really get really proficient. What about B? It's your turn. Any thoughts on any of these issues? B has just posted Gavin Dudney's post. We'll have a look at that while B is telling us what it's about.
Hi, Vance. No, I was just saying that, as Michael mentioned, it's still very clunky and it's still very expensive in terms of bandwidth, time, and all that. And unless classes change, unless schools change and institutions change, there's not much you can do. So I think that Dennis mentioned before that there must be a whole change in mentality, not only for teachers, because teachers are doing what they can, But I mean, I have a 50-minute class. I don't have anything in the classroom, so I don't have laptops there. The children are not allowed to use them, or mobiles or whatever. Okay, this is a top-down directive from school. So we have to go to the computer room, right, to do that. And it already takes us about 15 minutes to get settled. So that leaves us with 35 minutes class. The moment they, log onto their computers, there's no way we can do good work there, right? So the only thing that we can do is ask them to do at home where they have more time. And then you have complaints from parents who have to download things, and not all of them have their own computer. So it's a change in mentality. So you do it by little bits, right? You can do it. I faced a lot of opposition in the last 2 years. So while I was doing it without anyone knowing it, until 2006, that worked perfectly well because nobody was complaining. The moment people got word of what was going on, there's been a lot of opposition. So I was just shut down. And this year, I could not work on any of it, even if it's on the program, because most students, so you face opposition from teachers who are not using the tools at school, so you have a lot of pressure from them because they do not want to use it, from the board because they don't understand what you're doing. At least this is the situation at my school. In other schools, it's the other way around. So I belong to various communities of practice, and in some private schools, they are trying to implement new technologies, and teachers do not want to accept them. But they are not changing the structure, right, of the school. So it should be based on projects, and you should have more time, and it's interdisciplinary work. You cannot fit all this in 15 minutes in fragmented times as we have now for the discipline. So you have to change the whole thing, the whole structure, the whole way of working, the whole culture, right? If not, you just present little things and it doesn't make an impact.
Yeah, I agree. There are things that we have to cover in a curriculum that we have to test students on, and doing these kinds of web-based things do not always help students to achieve what they're required to achieve in a class, and time is limited. I have students in class for anywhere from 100 minutes to 150 minutes a day, 5 days a week, but I still have a lot of things that I have to cover. And most of the time, you know, just getting through that takes up pretty much all the time that I have.
Oh, grab the mic. I'm teaching, I'm focusing in one of my classes on Delicious and Google Docs, and I'm finding that the problem with Delicious is that the teachers where I work don't know about it, don't use it. The students go to the library, they never found the bookmarklets, they can't download them themselves because they don't have administration rights on those computers. And when I ask for them to be installed, they install them incorrectly, so that when students tag things, they don't necessarily show up in the searches on the tags. And this is really I didn't expect that kind of stumbling block. I'm going to Michael was putting some things on the board. He prepared slides in the 5 minutes while we were waiting for everybody to arrive. And so I thought maybe I'd sort of get him to talk a little bit about these points that he was making here. And I'd also like, before you leave, Michael, maybe to have a couple of moments just to talk about the future of learning in a networked Sundays. Just what we're doing here, just for a moment, before we all head out. So looks like something has gotten jammed up or overwritten on that slide. Can you fix it?
That time I had to go 4 times for the mic to be active. These also come from the Horizon Report, again, the Australian-New Zealand version And it identifies key trends as well as identifying technologies to watch. And these were the four kind of key statements they threw at the beginning of this year's report. And I don't have a lot to say about them. I think they're reasonably self-evident. I think they have particular relevance for the higher ed sector, not such a great relevance for schools and the sector that I work in Australia, which is more to do with people who are looking for jobs and vocational learning. But the last one is interesting. Our notions of space and what constitutes learning environments continues to evolve. And I think there's a couple of, well, there's a great phrase or quote that I came across from someone called Norbert Packler recently, and he says, the whole world has become curricularized. And this is part of the network learning we're talking about, that everybody is carrying a device that can record and document and use as a learning tool in relation to whatever's in front of you, whether it's a statue, a work of art, someone that you're interviewing, a picture of some, you know, building to illustrate architectural trends. Everywhere can be used as part as the learning environment. It's always been the case, but it's just now much, much easier. So they were the trends, and people might want to comment on any of those. Particularly interesting that first one, I think. The traditional publishing and textbook market is undergoing a profound and lasting change. And one of the things that we discovered when we were in South America, we being, I think it was Vance and I, when we were talking with Rita in Buenos Aires, she had been approached by publishers to come up with some ideas about how they might change their traditional textbook model, because they're aware that what's happening is putting their business under threat, and they want to work with teachers to create new models of business where the textbook has a new role. And that was in the English language learning context, but obviously it has big impact in the higher ed sector in terms of things like research. Any thoughts, anyone?
There seems to be a lot of thoughts in the text chat. Looking at Lynn is saying that, mentioning that in Australia somebody's looking for greater bandwidth so that they can reach people in rural locations. And of course, that's, I think, what Michael does. I don't know, I haven't really got my a vision of TAFE or what it is exactly. It seems to have things in lots of different places, but it certainly produces a lot of podcasts there, which suggests that there's a lot of what Alexander Hayes is doing, for example, with what does he call it? Point of view, POV technology. Yes, thank you, V. Where you can go out in the field and do so many things, you know, just by putting some glasses on that photograph what you're seeing and video what you're seeing. So in a way, that's kind of the same sort of, it's having the same impact on education and assessment, a lot of talk about assessment. But it's having the impacts as it becomes more and more ubiquitous and possible, and that, you know, mobile telephone technology will have. And of course, a lot of it depends on mobile technology, because I know, listening to Sue Waters' podcast, that a lot of it's being done on Blackberries and you know, with mobile devices with video. So this is one of these things. Yeah, and obviously, if you're living in a rural location, well, that's why in Northwest Canada and you know, some of the most work in e-learning is taking place in some of these places. But of course, the kinds of things that get done with e-learning is kind of what I'm a little wary about when you're in Argentina and talking with, I know the context, we know the context since we were there, what the mindsets that maybe kind of alluded to by B in Brazil. With one difference, that the strange thing in Argentina is when you know that these mindsets exist among educators where they're just not really developing themselves. But on the other hand, if you go to any cafe in Buenos Aires, it's going to have an internet connection, and you're going to be able to check your mail on your mobile, or you're going to be able to tweet from there. Just any cafe or restaurant, almost all of them have that kind of thing. It seems like it's everywhere, that we visited in Argentina, in a place where educators, you know, are not really accepting. They're not really making the paradigm shift to accommodate this. And so when we're talking about e-learning, models for e-learning, models for developing textbooks, when you in dialogue with publishers in the education sector, you know, what are those mindsets? Are they really going to, fortunately, there's some really good e-books on the topic. In fact, I've meant to thank B for sending me over to the one that you recommended for multiliteracies. I've downloaded it. I haven't read it yet, but I'll probably incorporate that. And there's a really nice one that Michael put us onto by, oh, come on. What are the names? Zittrain, Jonathan Zittrain. I took that one. I read that one on his suggestion, and I was surprised to find it was an e-book. But so, in a way, you know, some people say that content is free, and some of these people publishing really interesting e-books are actually putting them out for free, while also having one foot in the publishing world because you can actually buy hard copies of these things. So, and then Michael was talking the other day about the other day, I mean, in this in the podcast where you're talking about WikiLeaks, you were also talking about how the iPad has. Is just a completely different device, and I know for reading on it, it's pretty cool. So I don't know, you know, just things are coming along that are changing, you know, what the way we think about books and the way we, you know, obviously the booksellers are some of the most successful ones are going into the e aspects of their business.
I just want to flip back to the previous slide. Actually, Vance, can you moderate me, or just go back? If you could go back to the first slide, so that I just want to mention this thing, Flipboard. Now, if you have the chance and you've got an iPad, check this out, Flipboard. It's a free app, and what it does is create a magazine about people in your network. People who use Twitter will be familiar with the fact that you can now publish a daily, which is your own stuff. But it's a little bit similar to that. But this Flipboard application, I can put in, tell it to make a book about Vance Stevens, and it will show me everything Vance has read in the last week, every photograph he's put up, everything he's bookmarked. It is astounding. The way it gathers the content of someone in your network and makes it just so accessible and appealing. So it kind of models the sorts of things that Vance is talking about when you're reading, you know, on an e-book with all the rich media. It's just a brand new experience. Whole lot of issues there to do with cognitive overload and stuff, but we'll cope with that in time. Now, Vance, I'm going to go in about 5 minutes, so just in case some... Is there something else you said you wanted to talk about before I move off?
Yeah, well, actually I asked Michael and B if they could help me to find speakers for these events because, and other people volunteered as well. I think it's, you know, going fairly well. We've been able to sort of put something up, but we're always setting up events within a couple of days when they actually happen. It would be nice to get a little bit more sustainability. Dennis in Germany has actually volunteered to do a Speed Geek like this in February, so that's a real long-term plan, but it would just be nice if we could sort of get people aware that you know, this seems to be a kind of a nice thing to do. And there are other options. You can get into Classroom 2.0, which has got some really, Steve Hargadon interviews some amazing people. I think he's interviewed Clay Shirky and you name it. But anyway, I mean, he's got some really heavy hitters there. But it's interesting to listen to. They're all recorded, kind of like what we do. But we've been meeting here for the last 10 years, 12 years maybe. Going into 13, and we And just to what Bea says, she says it's difficult because it's on Sunday at early in the morning for them. It's about 9 o'clock in the morning in Brazil, which is a lot better than 6 in the morning like it is in California. But that's true. If you want to propose a different time, we could accommodate you, you know, or we would, maybe I would be asleep, but other people would join. So, you know, you don't really have to be stuck with this time. It's just that we just happen to have been meeting here at this time for so many years. It's just a space that seems to have carved itself out, and it's a niche, basically. And so I just decided to move into it and try to get things moving in that direction. So, I don't, does anybody have any ideas about what we could be doing to further the process of getting people, making sure that people do something, you know, that helps to teach one another at this time in the best way possible? I just put up our homepage for this, learningtogether.pbworks.com, and I'll make sure that gets published in the chat. There we go. Lynn just asked what topics would be most useful. And that's another way, something that occurred to me. I'm wondering if we could have maybe a part of this be a wiki that where people could, maybe we could open a Google Doc, let's say, and have people write down some topics that they would like to learn about, because maybe we could find presenters for those topics instead of having presenters come and drive it that way. Let's see, let's find somebody to speak. What shall we talk about? How about if we actually had people like me? I'd like to learn something about Google Calendars. Would anybody be able to present about Google Calendars? Can you tell me something about that? So if I could actually line somebody up from a user-driven perspective, that's a good idea, Lynn.
I don't think we need to be too prescriptive, Vance, about what topics, and I don't think you're suggesting that either, but to throw the wiki open to people to brainstorm a list of topics they would like to hear something about, I think it's a great idea. And maybe it's as simple as once you've got a group of people who have agreed to be collectively responsible for the program, it might work where it's just rotated. So it's my responsibility for week one of March, and week two might be B, week three might be Nina. So that way, and if there's, you know, 4 to 6 people on the group who are organizing it, it's not any load. It's just a quite an interesting task to select one person that you could negotiate with that individual about whether or not they wanted to do a sort of a full tilt presentation on a topic or a practical demonstration of something. I think we can just vary it.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be so formal as first week, second week, but, you know, just sending out your scouts, sort of, you know, the people we're putting here on the recording. People might listen to this recording, and we're saying to people in this room, if you happen to find people or know people that you might just encourage them to give a presentation, you know, in this venue, and we're looking for people. We're definitely, I've got a volunteers needed page here at this wiki, and it basically, I just might go click on it in the sidebar, but it's where we need people to fill in. Now, I've had some trouble with spammers on some of these wikis. Not everybody, unfortunately, is, behaves themselves, and it's a little bit of a pain to go and clean up the wiki and revert a couple of times a week once you get a spammer on here. So I'm sort of asking people if they would like to join the wiki, if you can join it. And if I know you, or even if you have a verified email address, it tells me if the email address of the joiner is verified or not, then I can add you to the wiki, or you can write me and tell me what you want to do, and I'll add it to the wiki. So either way, I don't really want to just open it up completely, because it gets to be a pain. That's just the way it is. So, but anyway, and I don't want to run on. We've gone over an hour now, and we started promptly tonight, which is kind of unusual. B has left tapped in already. So does anybody else have any other comments while these people are here? Okay, well, I might say thank you very much to Bea and Michael, who generously stayed up late in Australia and got up early at her mother's house in Sao Paulo for Bea, in the case of Bea. So thank you very much for coming to talk to us, and not only that, but drawing all these other people here, which is really, really making it interesting. So thanks for everybody for coming. And this is the 2nd of January 2011, and I always like to say the date and the time, and we're the webheads, and also, well, gosh, we spread into so many communities. We're just a network, basically, and we meet here every Sunday at noon, 1300 GMT, and we give presentations, and if you'd like to present, we'd love to hear from you, and our URL is basically learning together with a learning the number two together, all one word, tbworks.com. So thanks again for coming. And last comments. This is a recording that could just go on and on, so we'll just leave the mic open for a while just in case anybody wants to say anything. Happy New Year. That's a nice thing to say. Okay, I might add that the way this works is that when people leave the room, and we stop the recording, then people can leave the room, and when everybody has left the room, I'll be the last one out. I'll turn out the lights, as it were, and when I do that, the recording gets put up at the Illuminate server, and then we find the URL, and we'll send it out on the Webheads list, and I'll tweet it, and we'll put it at the URL, this one right here, the Learning Together URL, our archive. Okay, well, thanks for coming again, and if nobody says anything in the next few minutes, we'll stop the recording. Bye-bye.